You are listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network. One of Us is a podcast and video network funded all but entirely by donations and subscriptions. We do accept pitches for audio-based or banner ads, but on a case-by-case basis. If you are interested in that, contact us at oneofusnet@gmail.com. With the amount of audio and video content we generate, it is expensive and extremely time-consuming to keep things running. Please go to the webpage oneofus.net and sign up for a subscription at $2, $5, $10, or $25 and get a ton of bonus content. One of Us needs and appreciates all your support.
How much for that woman in the window?
Wow. It's the red light district now or something.
No, okay. I was just trying to think of something cute and clever. I thought of how much is that doggy in the window. I don't know.
That's cute. I like that. Yeah.
I got to say, though, I think I'll pass on this particular woman. I think I'll go to the next one.
No shade, Amy Adams. No shade, Amy Adams, but we don't want to buy
you. No, I would want my money back for this. Oh, man. This is... Yeah, I'm kind of shocked. This is the newest film from Joe Wright, The Woman in the Window. It's based on a book, which, from what I understand, one, this is actually a very faithful adaptation of the book, except for a few changes they did in reshoots. And then two, the book itself is also not terribly well received. This seems like it was rolling on the hype of that 2010 period of books like Gone Girl, The Girl on the Train.
What, you know, what's so funny is that the book came out in 2018, like, or first half of 20, first quarter, I guess, and then I think almost immediately this had to go in like straight when the that thing was in galley form, and then like they shot this fall, so like, man, that was like either was like really huge belief in the book, which turned out to be true because it was a huge bestseller, or just not people just not knowing what they're doing.
I'm in Barnes and Noble like every other day. I'm a huge bookworm, and I had never heard of this thing until I heard that we were going to be reviewing the film adaptation. And I was like, when it comes to me and and not knowing about a book, I'm like, that's not a particularly good sign.
No.
You see, I feel like I heard I could not escape this book. I feel like, you know, you start seeing, you hear about something one time and then it keeps on finding you in different like areas. And that's what happened with me in this book in 2018. And I said, oh, Amy Adams. Oh, Julianne Moore. Okay, that's going to happen. I purposely did not read the book. I thought, I want to see the movie. Because I read the plot thinking, oh, this, I think I'd like to experience this more as a film than I would as a book. And I kept on watching it thinking I would rather read this than I would have watched it.
Yeah. I mean, because a big thing about the book is that it's all written in first person, which they tried their best to keep it grounded in Amy Adams' perspective. But I feel like that works way better in a book in this case. And also, just as interesting as the actual plot and story of the film in terms of like how crazy it gets, is the crazy story behind how this movie got to Netflix. Because, right, so like Frank said, this was shot in 2018, and then they did a bunch of test screenings when it was still under Fox's banner, and audiences hated it because apparently the mystery elements were so opaquely described to people in the film that by the end of it, people were confused how it got to where it got to. So they actually went back and reshot a bunch of key scenes to more or less spell out the plot for in some cases.
Wow.
You can kind of tell which scenes were the reshot scenes.
Yeah. I don't know about anybody else. I'd rather be confused than bored.
I guess.
To be honest with you.
For this simple mystery, if it was too hard for people to understand, that's on the director. That's on the director's case in that situation.
Well, the thing is, you say that this is, like, you'd rather be confused than bored. I wasn't bored because I was fascinated with how stupid this was at every turn. Yep. Other than that, they did reshoots to make the mystery less opaque. Hate to tell you guys, it didn't work.
Nope. And then, on top of all the other troubles, Fox got sold to Disney, and then it was in limbo forever until Netflix scooped it up and then just pooped it out like everything else in their content.
It also went through the COVID postponement as well. Like, yeah, rather movie too. So I mean, this movie just had bad luck from the get go. This was just not meant to happen.
But this review was meant to happen because hey, I'm Justin Zarin, everybody. Hey, over here we got Frank.
Man, I love a good movie star looking at another movie star through a window. Like I told Melina before, we're not talking about what lies beneath, are we, Melina?
We always could.
Nope. And there's Melina, so.
Good evening. That's my bad Hitchcock impersonation, just like this movie is.
Oh, man. Yes, we should actually explain what the plot is before we just crap on this film more. So, You know what, Frank? We haven't talked to you in a while. Why don't you give us a little summary here? What is The Woman in the Window about?
So in this movie, Amy Adams plays Dr. Anna Fox, a child psychologist, psychiatrist, one of those, living by herself in a lavish, lavish Brooklyn townhome, which has to be in the millions, and it's nicer than any place I've ever been to. And it's, you know, I can see kind of why she's a shut-in, because that's a pretty cool place to live. Lives with her cat and a tenant named David, played by Wyatt Russell. She's taking a bunch of pills to deal with her separation from her husband and a bunch of us. I actually don't really know why she's taking a lot of pills and why she's agoraphobic, but she is.
She has a lot of anxiety.
She's got a lot of anxiety.
There's nothing big to reveal about it, but for a long time, you're not entirely clear why it's happening, even though you can kind of guess at some point.
She needs to take pills, and she apparently needs to take them with wine. She meets, the only really point of contact that she's got is Tracy Letts, who plays her psychiatrist, who comes and does house calls, I think, once a week, twice a week. Anyhow, new family moves across the street, played by the, what are their names? The Russells.
The Russells. Which Wyatt Russell's not a part of that family.
No. Goldie and Kurt are not moving across the street. It is actually Gary Oldman and Julianne Moore and their teenage son. And very quickly, the teenage son comes over, introduces himself, and Dr. Anna Fox lets him in. They develop a little rapport. He leaves. Sometime later, his mom, Julianne Moore, comes over, Jane. They strike up a friendship, bond over some wine. She draws a picture. They play with the cat. They banter.
So instantly best friends, of course.
Yeah, instantly BFFs. Like, there's that much
competition. That's how we ladies make friends.
Well, there's also not that much competition for best friends in Amy Adams' life in this movie. But, yeah. Anyway, cut to a couple nights later. She's in the bathtub drinking a glass of wine because she's probably just taking some pills, and she hears some screaming. She looks across the street from her window and sees Julianne Moore's character, Jane, being flung across the room with a knife in her stomach, and never sees her again. She's convinced that the Russells have killed Jane and calls in Brian Tyree Henry, plays a local police detective.
And his bitch assistant.
Oh, I can't. I couldn't stand her. I was trying to just like take her out of my memory for this stuff.
I'm sorry.
They come over. They bring the Russells over with a different Jane Russell, played by Jennifer Jason Leigh, who we always love seeing.
Which bringing over that couple is definitely not police procedure.
No, it's so not. It's so not.
That stuck in my craw so much watching this movie.
Nobody believes her. Everyone thinks she's crazy. Is she crazy? Is she not crazy? Do we really care by the end of it? I didn't really care by the end of it. But that's the gist of The Woman in the Window.
Yep, it's Rear Window, essentially. Like, literally, it is just Rear Window, but with some modern twists here and there. You know?
It's the first third of What Lies Beneath.
Well, that too.
You are obsessed with Michelle Pfeiffer. Oh my God.
a little bit. I am wearing her fragrance right now, and I'm not joking. It's a genderless fragrance called Henry Rose. Check it out, people.
You're like me with Mark Strong. I'll just find any excuse to talk about them.
We need to do a live watch of Stardust then, Melina.
I have many times. Just by myself, though.
You're also kind of like my wife now, where anytime Wyatt Russell's in anything, she's just like, every single time. That was the only thing that was keeping her awake in this movie, was anytime Wyatt Russell showed up. Which, honestly, with him and Anthony Mackie being in this movie, which, man, freaking Anthony Mackie phoning in half his performance in this movie, literally. Oh, I have to assume they were filming Winter Soldier nearby, and they just took the coffee breaks and did The Woman in the Window for a bit.
It feels like everybody is phoning it in, except for Amy Adams, and that's not because they're bad actors or because they, you know, because they don't have charisma. It's because they're literally given nothing to do. Barely. They're almost like, they're like touchstones. They're just kind of like, okay, introduce this character 15 minutes in, introduce this character 20 minutes in, and they give them nothing to do other than just show up long enough for you to be like, I recognize that person. Well, good. They're gone now. And I hope you enjoyed seeing them.
I think everybody here is fine. Really? Except for Wyatt Russell, only because he's the only one of the group that is the kind of actor that needs a good script to do good work.
Yeah.
Like he can't just naturally produce believability. When I saw him, like, he has a temper tantrum at some point during this, and I thought, oh my god.
See, I preferred him over the person playing the son, Fred Heckinger, because I thought that guy was just terrible.
He was awful. Mm-hmm. Oh my god. He's like the kind of person who they deliver their lines the way I would deliver those lines. Because I can't act, and I've never taken an acting class in my life.
It's sad, because he's been in some other movies. Like, he was in 8th Grade. He was in News of the World just this last year.
He was in 8th Grade. Oh, that's right. I loved him in 8th Grade.
He's a relatively new actor, but still, this was way too big a role that he was not ready for in this case. So
perhaps.
Every time he talked, I'm like, that's the script telling you you have to deliver your line like that, paired with Joe Wright, the director, telling him, all right, deliver your line like this. And I'm like, that's just... It's embarrassing watching it.
Yeah, we got to talk about the people involved with making this movie. So the script actually is two people's fault, because it's Tracy Letts who wrote the script, for one thing, which that's why he gave himself the role.
Oh, that's so mind-boggling to me, because I love Tracy Letts' writing.
Then when they did the reshoots, they brought in Tony Gilroy, because he's the professional rewrite doctor, essentially.
Oh my
so
God.
They brought him to rewrite the confusing scenes that Tracy Letts didn't write very well. So they're responsible for the mess with the script here. But then, I don't know what happened here, but just say... This is like the least Joe Wright film I've seen in a long time, which is saying something, because Pan also doesn't feel like a Joe Wright film, but at least that has the spectacle, that has the glamour and some of the crazy art design that he does. This one is just the blandest, regularest looking film that he's ever shot.
Well, I thought that there was some interesting style choices here and there, and that's because the movie is... And normally when I say wearing something on its sleeve, that's meant as sort of a metaphor, but this movie is literally wearing Rear Window on its sleeve. It opens with still frames from the climactic scene from Rear Window, which I'm like, foreshadowing much?
I think it's sort of them saying, like, all right, you're going to call us off a Rear Window, so we're going to call ourselves out.
Yeah, but then they keep doing that. They keep showing old 50s thriller films in the background.
Which was fun for me.
Sure!
I was happy when they showed Gene Tierney, because I'm like, hey, distant relative!
Oh, yeah, are you related to Gene Tierney, distantly?
Yep. Oh.
Are you? That is so cool. I love Gene Tierney.
Yeah, my maternal grandmother's maiden name is Tierney. That's where I get all my Irish roots.
Nice.
Yeah, well, watching those clips were more interesting than watching anything else that they were trying to overtly homage. Because seriously, like, there's so many things, like the photography stuff that she's doing. It's like, oh, gee, yeah, it's a camera just like the one in Rear Window. The way they frame the shots looking over the other house are just like the Rear Window shots. It's not wearing a sleeve, it's wearing a coat, like a trench coat that has Rear Window all over it.
I love that she's a child psychologist. Whatever. She's a doctor, but she's automatically also a photographer. I love that.
Yeah, like, sure, why not?
Did they ever explain why she has the camera?
No.
It's just there.
That's the big MacGuffin of Hitchcock. And this is not me being pretentious film school nerd. The guy invented the MacGuffin, all right? So I'm allowed to talk about it. With Rear Window, you had, you know, everybody who knows anything about film knows that Jimmy Stewart, he broke his legs. He is confined to his apartment. And he spends his time waiting for his hot Grace Kelly girlfriend to come over by looking at what his neighbors are doing through his camera. And... Yeah. They do the same thing here, and they're trying to very obviously pay homage, but it doesn't make any sense.
Well, also, it's like, but Jimmy Stewart was a photographer in that film. They're over here. Why didn't they just give her binoculars?
Yeah.
Let her use her iPhone, because they make the iPhone such a central part of the mystery, but then she has a separate camera anyway. That was just one of many things that was a problem with this movie, because honestly, I could, you know, we don't have enough time to talk about the entirety of why the plot is stupid.
Oh, we'd be here all night.
Yeah.
One of the things that I found really, really glaring is that whenever they felt unsure about the script, they always threw in like one of the special effects, which I thought were so incredibly laughable and just totally unnecessary.
It felt like Joe Wright was bored during those scenes, so he had to like amp up the situation, like, okay, put the camera on a rocking chair, or put the camera Dolly David Fincher style across the counter here. Do something. Make the scene more interesting looking.
Yeah. They also did the same thing with Danny Elfman's score. This movie is so overscored.
Oh my god,
it's overscored.
This is one of the worst Danny Elfman scores I've heard in a while. And it wasn't supposed to be him originally. It was supposed to be Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, funny enough.
I know,
And they took one look at this and they're like, no. We just did Soul. We've got better things to do. But I mean, that's just another thing that was meant to be, I guess, an homage to the era of Hitchcock and his films, because the score is decidedly very Bernard Herrmann. to the point where you just can't miss it when you hear it, but it's so generic and it's so poking you in the ribs every time they play it, like, hey, get it? We know Hitchcock. I'm like, guys, enough already, okay?
It's so overwrought, every single scene it's in. It's just loud and noisy and chaotic. It's just, it's distracting at points. Like, there's literally that point when the kids outside during Halloween are egging your house and the score is just blaring loudly at you. It's like, I get it's supposed to reflect her mental problems, but it's too much. It's just too much in this one scene. Which also, this movie hates kids, clearly. Like, this, every kid or teenager in this movie is terrible in some capacity.
Yeah, I mean, I've got kids living next to me. I can tell you that that's not exactly far from the truth.
I guess.
I'm not the biggest fan of kids either. I kind of agree with that as well. But I think that the script is too frenetic, and I get that it is meant to, like, echo her mental imbalance, but it kind of screws us over as an audience, especially when it hits you that there's not a lot here to actually solve.
It's a really simple mystery. It's actually not that complicated.
Yeah. All you really got at that point is just performances. Mm-hmm. There's no mystery here. There isn't. And it all culminates in this finale that is just... It's pretty much cartoonish, and I say that, and just like, it is cartoonish.
I think Joe Wright handed the camera over to Sam Raimi to direct that final sequence, because it's yes. It felt like the ending of Drag Me to Hell, where it suddenly is like, what is happening in this sequence?
And I love Drag Me to Hell.
Me too.
I said the same thing in a great way. I said the same thing, like, what the hell is happening here, in an amazing way, and like, out of joy. I was like, what the fuck is going on now here?
But you were talking about how it's a very simple mystery. And the thing is, when you go back and you watch Rear Window, it is a very simple mystery itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, you go back and you watch a lot of Hitchcock's movies, they are very simple premises, but that's why you tip your hat to Hitchcock, because the guy really was the master of suspense. He knew how to take something and make it so that it wasn't really about the plot so much as it was the feeling of suspense and angst and just being uncomfortable the entire time that you're watching. And I'm like, you know, for being in the early age of the talkies, as they used to say, the guy was so good at it that they still, for the most part, translate to today. This is trying so hard to pay homage and yet try to reinvent the wheel. And really, I'm like, guys, you can have a simple story, but it has to actually earn it. It has to earn itself. It has to earn where we end up, and it has to be shocking. I don't know about you guys, but I figured out who the bad guy was the moment they popped up on screen.
I had a feeling it was them, but I just thought to myself, no, that would be really dumb if that was the case. But this is also the woman in the window we're talking about, so.
As soon as Julianne Moore shows up, for my money, the mystery's over.
Yeah.
You know, and their first interactions with each other, I was like, oh, okay. All right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know what you're doing. I know what ace you have up your sleeve.
Which, just to wind down and start talking about some things, is that I feel like one thing, again, this is a backhanded compliment saying that Amy Adams is trying her best in this role, but honestly, her character is just so aggressively unlikable at points, because I get she's supposed to be having these instable behaviors because of something that happened to her, but that's all she is for most of the story. She's just a bundle of nerves and neuroses and psychotic behavior, and you never actually learn anything about her as a person other than the bad stuff that's happened to her. Like, you never know her skill set, so when she suddenly pulls out a camera out of nowhere, you're like, oh, I guess she's a photographer now. And you know, that's the thing that kills the mystery, because you never feel like she's actually able to solve anything. She's just some crazy woman who's living down the street from these people and goes, oh, I saw someone get stabbed. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
You know?
It could have happened to the person in the next brownstone, you know?
It could have happened to Wyatt Russell. It would have been an even more interesting movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so, too. Yeah.
I mean, he really... Well,
there's that crazy lady upstairs.
Dude, that's a great movie right there. This dude who's... he's on parole. He's got a pretty crappy job going on. There's a crazy lady he's living with upstairs. And then there's a murder across the street. That's a movie right there.
I'm like, did that crazy lady kill her? Oh my god, am I fucking next? No,
yeah. Oh, I want to watch that movie now. Joe Wright, why didn't you listen to that
movie? I just kept watching him and I was like, he is so the Grace Kelly role here. And like, I love how they...
Wyatt Russell?
Yes. The fact that, you know, because with Rear Window, you've got Grace Kelly, who's the girlfriend, who's kind of, you know, she kind of comes in and out and she's there so that... Jimmy Stewart has somebody to relay the plot points to, like, hey, I've been noticing this.
I thought he was more Thelma Ritter, to be honest with you.
No.
Because she does stuff, and, you know.
Yeah, no, it's... I am so upset. You know, it's so sad. I didn't want to go into this movie being angry about it, but the more I thought of it, the more I'm like, you know what? I just saw the most recent Saw movie, Spiral, the other day, and I think I actually liked that more than this movie. Because that movie is dumb, but at least it's a Saw movie. You know what you're going into right off the bat when you know it's a Saw movie. This movie, it had such a pedigree to it that for it to flounder at almost every single corner was just kind of embarrassing and upsetting, to be honest.
Yeah, it really was.
Yeah, so I don't know. We're just going to wind up final thoughts then, because I kind of hated this movie, honestly. And, you know, I feel like I've been a curmudgeon on some of the reviews lately, but I also have to take back some of the stuff I said about Saw, where I'm like, you know what? I at least had some moments where I was kind of mildly amused with Saw in retrospect. This one, I was just frustrated and bored and annoyed with how many inconsistent behaviors. Like, it feels like Joe Wright wanted to direct this as a play. Because the fact of everyone coming into this one house, because almost 95% of the film is shot in this one location, this giant freaking mansion of a townhouse. And the problem is that causes so many factual and logical inconsistencies with stuff that happened in the film. You're like, but wait, how did that, but then why did that, but then how does this?
It would make a really great, it would make a really great play. It would make a really great play, especially if the audience never sees what she's seeing.
Yeah.
In terms of like the murder and everything, that'd be really great. But they did something similar, didn't they? They did that with Sorry, Wrong Number.
Oh, right.
Which is a really great Barbara Stanwyck noir, which I love. I love to death.
Yeah.
I'm going to watch that instead of this.
I just have really not many good things to say about this. It's got the bare minimum of competent production value to not be a total train wreck kind of thing. But I would never watch this again. I don't want to think about it anymore, because I feel like I'm already going to start forgetting this within the week about what happened to this movie, except for the incredibly ludicrous plot twist that happens at the very end, because they pull out some stuff in the ending here. That's clearly one of the giant reshoots that they did for this movie, and you can tell because they spelled out everything to you in that sequence.
Oh my god. At that point, I was like, did they make a parody and just forget to make it funny?
That would have been better if it had done that route, but... Yeah, I did not enjoy this, so I am going to give this movie 2 out of 10 Adorable Cats Named Punch.
There you go.
I was going to give it higher, but now that I thought about it, I'm like, no, 2 is probably about the right level to give this movie.
Even the cat looked bored the whole time. Like, the cat couldn't
give, meow.
That cat couldn't give two shits who walked in the door or not. I mean, honestly.
Yeah, that's like most cats.
Especially in the ending when she's putting it in a bag and the cat's just clearly like, don't put me in there.
I know, right? You can tell that cat did not want to go into that bag. You could tell. This is a real shame because I think there are some legitimate stuff that does work here. I think the cinematography was pretty, and I agree it's probably it's not his best work looking at his filmography.
Well, yeah, because he did Inside Llewyn Davis, Harry Potter Part 6, The Darkest Hour, which he did recently with the same director.
And I love Darkest Hour. I think it's an interesting choice that worked more here than it didn't. I like seeing these actors work together. Except for Wyatt Russell, because you're just bad. You're a tall drink of water, and yeah, but you're bad. I'm so sorry.
Again, I would take 2 hours of him more than one more minute of Fred Heckinger in this movie. So.
But I did like watching these actors work together. I loved Julianne Moore and Amy Adams share screen time together.
There was not enough of them.
No.
There is not enough of them at all, and you know that there's not going to be enough of them, so you just start mourning that slowly. The first hour or so of this is passable at best.
Yeah.
But then that point in the film when Amy Adams expertly delivers this great monologue with everybody around, and as soon as that screen goes dark, oh my god, that movie turns from like, okay, you're really mediocre, but now, oh, we're just descending, it's just flat out horrible. And the movie never recovers from that. It tries so desperately to recover, and you could tell where all the patchwork is. Mm-hmm. It's just a shame. And it really is kind of, you know, was it the author A.J. Finn? No, he knows how to spin a yarn that clearly a lot of people have, you know, have been taken with, regardless of like whatever I think of it. Tony Gilroy and Teresa Letts, they know how to write. Joe Wright knows how to direct. I just can't think of any reason why it should have been delivered to us in this way. Other than it just shouldn't have happened.
Yeah, or I was going to say delivered at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just should not have existed. But it does. And because it does, I am going to give this, I'll probably give it on the higher end scale. I'm going to give it 4 out of 10 copies of The Woman in the Window, which is the 1940 noir mystery starring Edward G. Robinson. It's a fantastic film. No relation in any way, shape, or form to plot-wise to this film. Seek it out. It is very good. It's a good piece of film noir.
You know, it almost feels like this is as much a disaster behind the scenes as The Snowman was in terms of book to film.
Yes.
I never saw that. Does that live up to that reputation, that movie?
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Oh, God.
They literally cut out entire sequences from the book that they couldn't film that contain the important aspects of the mystery in those scenes. So,
yeah, which was
the
so
mystery
tragic.
Is ruined in the film.
We've been talking so much about, you know, the great influence behind this, the people behind the camera, the people in front of the camera. I'm like, I don't know how the hell you have a movie with Amy Adams, Julianne Moore, Gary Oldman, for crying out loud, and walk away having nothing to say about them. That, I think, is a tragedy in and of itself. And mm-hmm. I think that it just goes to show that even master craftsmen can't polish a turd. And that's exactly what this is. I appreciated that it was trying to pay respectable homage to Hitchcock, right down to the brownstone house being pretty much the same layout as the house from Psycho. If you actually go back and watch the layout of it, it's the house from Psycho.
That's pretty interesting. I'm not gonna do that, but that's pretty cool. That's legitimately cool. I like that. Yeah.
Just go and look at pictures on Google Image, and you'll see what I'm talking about. You know,
do that. Yeah.
If you have not already seen this movie, you don't have to. This I thought was just boring at best, absolutely laughable at worst, and it's something that I was pulling for because of all the people that we've mentioned who are behind it. I can't believe that this is as much of a just hot mess as it is. But I am done talking about this fucking thing for as long as I live. So I am going to give this 1 out of 5 very inappropriate use of gardening tools.
Oh, God. Yeah, man. Also, incidentally, it's The Woman in the Window, 1944. Edward G. Robinson, Joan Bennett, and it's a Fritz Lang movie. So kids, go look that up.
You actually went really and caught good. It, didn't you?
No, I remember I had my iPad. Because I'm a sharp knife, yeah.